From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. Let's rewind time to June 26, 2000.
Good morning.
President Bill Clinton is making a major announcement.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome.
The possibilities seemed endless.
Picture a world where cancer is cured with a packet of pills.
On today's show, a look at the promise of personalized medicine through genetic information.
For some patients, it helps them understand why they don't need chemotherapy.
And the challenges.
You have a risk of heart disease, you have a risk of breast cancer, not that you definitely will get it.
Also on the show, Americans don't seem to care very much about climate change.
It's near the bottom of the list.
Could an artist help make the point?
There was no way I could make a beautiful painting that didn't have another purpose.
First, the news from NPR.
Only liquid saliva counts, so bubbles don't count.
This is the sound of people learning more about their health risks. It's The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez-Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Maiken Scott. The Pulse will wait for elevators or for moss to grow to understand the latest science and research.
Energy right where you use it. Point of use energy generation.
You're really just a very specialized fish walking on very modified fins.
It's kind of like, how did they do that? How did they have that capability when we don't?
Anesthetics are really good at what they do.
If it gives people pleasure, if someone's making money off of it, it must be bad.
I don't know, it's a mess.
Right.
Could this be elevated potassium, but I'm afraid to say it's wrong.
To think like a soul.
I'm literally holding in my hands a human heart.
On today's show, an artist drives home what scientists struggle to explain about climate change, mining earwax for information, and using robots to help people recover. But first, back to people spitting into tubes. For science, of course. A saliva sample is often the first step in genetic testing. And joining us now is Tanya English. Tanya, it's been more than a decade since we first heard about the big promise of genome sequencing, making medicine personalized to our own DNA. What's the reality? What's happening?
So one thing that's happened in the last couple of years is that companies have lined up to cash in. They're selling these direct-to-consumer genetic testing kits. Here's a commercial from the company 23andMe.
Arthritis. Gallstones.
Hemochromatosis.
I'll look into that.
Stuff we might pass on to our kids.
Foods I might want to avoid.
Hundreds of things about my health.
Getting my 23andMe results?
It really opened my eyes.
So a lot of people, including experts at the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, are skeptical about how these tests can be used by us consumers, and they sent a warning letter to 23andMe. Jonathan Moreno is an ethicist at the University of Pennsylvania, and he says right now we just don't have definitive answers about how genetic testing will change our lives and our health.
The best advice is still get 8 hours of sleep, eat a balanced meal, probably check your cholesterol. Eat fiber, live in a place where there are not a lot of gunshots, don't cross the street if there are a lot of trucks around, and choose your parents wisely.
Okay, so perhaps I'm not going to use genetic testing at home to determine my risks for certain diseases, but where are these tests being used, and are there examples where they are really helpful?
Yes, I have an example for you. So there are now tests that predict how breast cancer is likely to behave in the future, and that information lets doctors tailor their therapy recommendations. Genomic testing for breast cancer comes after a patient is treated locally. So once a woman has a surgery or a targeted radiation to clear a tumor from her body, the next big question is, will the cancer come back?
Tumors can look very quiet and calm under the microscope and then have bad biologic behavior.
So that's Beth Dupree. She's a breast surgeon at the Holy Redeemer Health System in suburban Philadelphia. Dupree says genomic testing tells her more about the biology of a cancer. She's trying to figure out if a cancer is switched on. Switched on describes a cancer that's aggressive, or switched on can mean a tumor with DNA programming that allows it to spread to the brain or to bone.
That tumor knows how to get out of the breast and find another place to live.
Now, there are several companies that offer the test, but two brands are popular, Mammaprint and Oncotype DX. With either test, patients can basically learn if there's a high risk or a low risk that a cancer will return. Not every tumor needs to be treated with chemotherapy. Dupree says genomic testing helps her decide which cancers do and which cancers don't.
I tell people that their tumor's lazy and it doesn't want to go anywhere. And so in those tumors, chemotherapy is typically not beneficial because cells need to be dividing at a rapid rate in order for chemotherapy to be most effective.
If a genomic profile shows that a cancer is aggressive, Dupree says she can more confidently recommend an aggressive whole-body treatment like chemotherapy. Chemotherapy has some tough side effects that most patients want to avoid, but it's also protection, Dupree says, against a cancer that's likely to strike again.
You can't buy hurricane insurance the day after the storm hits your beach house. So to me, chemotherapy is often like buying an insurance policy.
Genomic testing is often just another thing to do during a very tough time. 51-year-old Carrie Grundman learned about the test while she was recovering from her mastectomy. She was hoping to hear the all clear from her breast surgeon when a medical assistant mentioned they were waiting for Grundman's genomic test results.
And I said, what? I don't remember anything about an Oncotype test.
So after that first round of genomic testing, which cost about $4,000, Grundman was still in a middle ground. It wasn't clear if she would benefit from chemotherapy.
One group said, yes, absolutely, you need to get the chemotherapy. Others were saying it's your decision.
Then doctors offered her a second, newer test. Eventually, she learned that even though her tumor was small, the cancer was high risk.
Now you have an answer.
Grundman needed chemotherapy. And at first, she took it hard.
For me personally, it was the hair loss.
Grundman is 6 feet tall with shoulder-length red hair. And she admits she's won a job or two because she's memorable.
My hair really identified me. And when I realized that I was going to lose my hair, it was like a part of my identity was going to be gone.
Still, being a mom, being a wife, being here mattered more. Grundman says ultimately genomic testing offered a certainty that this was the right choice for her. Nurse practitioner Liz Santisero says that's the idea, to give women personalized precision medicine.
You know, it's about you, not about everybody else.
Santisero works at Jefferson University Hospital. When a woman learns that she has breast cancer, Santisero is the one that helps the woman figure out what's next.
For some patients, it helps them understand why they don't need chemotherapy.
Montgomery County mom Chris Pierce was diagnosed with breast cancer back in 2012. Her surgeon told Pierce that she had a large lazy tumor that had likely been smoldering in her breast for years. A MammaPrint test suggested that Pierce could safely skip chemotherapy.
So at the time, all it meant to me initially was I didn't need chemotherapy. I don't need chemotherapy.
Pierce was able to return to work quickly after surgery, and today she takes a prevention pill once a day. That's all good news. Still, Pierce says she wanted to be absolutely sure she was doing everything she could.
Do you need it? Do you not need it? You think to yourself, well, if I could only know. I knew it wasn't going to come back, then I wouldn't bother to get chemo. So I kind of think of this as my little crystal ball, although it's, you know, obviously it's not 100%. Nothing is.
Many cancer specialists are still learning about genomic testing, and research is still underway to figure out which patients would benefit most. Breast surgeon Beth Dupree only recommends the test for patients with early stage disease. When a cancer spreads to other parts of the body, she says she absolutely recommends chemotherapy.
So in those cases, there's no reason to get this test.
So, Mikan, this is just one example. Genomic testing in breast cancer is one in a long line of different kinds of genetic tests that you can get.
Tanya, I have a question for you. What is the difference between genomic and genetic tests?
You know, it's an important distinction. So I spoke with Randy Scott. His company is Invitae, and they make genetic tests that you can order through your doctor. And I started with that question first.
I like to think of genetics as about family. Genetics is really about the genes you inherited from your mom and dad. And so it really is the genetic makeup that runs through your family. Where genomics, in some ways, is personal. It's your genome and how the structure and expression of that genome affects you over the course of your life, which is also affected by the environment.
Some celebrities like Angelina Jolie have been really public about their genetic testing and the treatment options that they pursued after that. How is that changing the conversation when celebrities are in on the discussion?
There was more awareness about the risk of hereditary breast cancer from women who knew that they had family events, but maybe just never quite acknowledged did or really thought about it, for whom that was an inspiration to go to their doctor and say, you know, I have breast cancer running in my family. Is it possible that I actually share this gene. And in that particular case, there's a lot that you can do to prevent the cancer from ever arising.
A lot of our listeners will have heard about take-home kits like 23andMe. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that's different from what Invitae is offering.
Yeah. So the difference is 23andMe is looking for some very common simple mutations called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms. In our case, we're doing deep sequencing that allows you to look at a variety of different types of even complex mutations. For example, this is something that happened to a family member. I lost a nephew, died at the age of 28 of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy a number of years ago. And it turns out there's probably dozens of genes and thousands of mutations that can result in defects that can cause sudden cardiac death. Those are the types of diseases that we're focused on versus a simple question of, do you have a higher risk for diabetes or heart disease?
Can I call up your company and just have that test? How does it work?
All of our tests require a physician to order. So you would have to go through your treating physician. They would order the test.
Why go through the physician? Why do you think that's important?
Genes are the fundamental particle of medicine. It is probably not the cause of every disease, but certainly involved in every disease. And one of the things that we need to do over the next decade is really teach and train physicians. And so we feel like if we don't bring the medical community along, we'll have lost a great opportunity to really impact the future in a meaningful way.
So I might have a very good primary physician, but it could have been 10 or 20 years since he took a genetics class.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
What do you already know about the challenges of integrating this into routine healthcare?
Even as I've talked to my own family members, some of them are excited about the potential of getting genetic testing. Others are like, I don't really want to know. For example, do I have a predisposition towards Alzheimer's, which we can do nothing about today?
So how do you let people choose how much information they want to get? What's the device to make that happen?
All of this is moving online. So it would be like having your own Facebook page, only medically related, where it could be only you that can see the information, and then you can let doctors at your discretion see that information, or other family members for whom it might be helpful. The implications throughout families of families helping each other to understand more about what their genetic makeup means and helping each other to eat healthier, be healthier if you're at risk for diabetes or heart conditions or disease, I think has a tremendous capability to impact healthcare.
But I wonder if we have enough of a workforce of genetic counselors and people who know this science to help us all out with this.
Yeah, genetic counselors are the unsung heroes of this whole space. There are about 3,000 to 4,000 genetic counselors in all of North America, which if you think for 300 million plus population, it's absolutely not enough. A career now in genetic counseling, I think, is going to be extremely valuable over the next decade.
When I talk to ethicists about this, they worry about a genetic divide between those who have access to these kind of tests and the kind of precision, personalized medicine that can come out of it and those who don't. Where are we with that now?
The cost of DNA sequencing are coming down so rapidly. We fully expect that within the next 5 years, we'll reach the level where you can get a significant amount of genetic testing for a few hundred dollars. So anybody in a modern healthcare system should have access. And of course, we have to do a good job of showing that we can use that information to actually improve healthcare.
Pulse reporter Tanya English speaking with Randy Scott. His company Invitae makes genetic tests. You're listening to The Pulse. Our regular contributor, Dr. Bethany Brookshire, also known as PsyCurious, recently mentioned a study that sounded rather disgusting.
They looked at different kinds of earwax, and there's a single genetic polymorphism, a change in a single gene, that determines whether or not you have liquidy, waxy earwax or dry, crumbly earwax. And it turns out that gene also determines how much your earwax smells. So people with liquidy earwax have really smelly earwax, and people with dry earwax have less smelly earwax.
That got our attention, obviously. You're never too old to activate your inner fourth grader. And so we headed over to Philadelphia's Monell Chemical Senses Center and met up with organic chemist Dr. George Preddy, who's in charge of this earwax research. And indeed, his team broke down people's earwax to its volatile compounds, which make up smell.
Maybe it's good for a few yucks right now, but we see it as a potentially good diagnostic medium.
So Preddy says the body's metabolism produces lots of small volatile compounds that end up in your earwax and can thus offer clues to illness or a person's diet.
So at lunchtime, I quite often eat an orange every day. So one of the things we saw in my earwax was after lunch was that I had a lot of this compound called limonene, which is present in high abundance in the skin of oranges.
Preddy says going forward, earwax could be used in the same way urine or blood is used right now in diagnosing people. And to illustrate his point, he told me this story.
There was a very interesting article that appeared regarding a whale. It's another mammal that produces earwax, but they don't have hands and they don't have Q-tips. So the earwax in the whale builds up over time. And in this whale that was killed accidentally by a ship, researchers removed an earwax plug that was 22 centimeters long, and it contained the whole life history of the whale in terms of organic chemicals that had dissolved within the earwax, which was, I thought, a very nice demonstration that earwax is almost like tree rings. It tells you, you could tell when the whale reached puberty. You could tell when the whale was swimming in water that was polluted with mercury because all these things were embedded within the earwax. You know, testosterone levels were high in certain parts. When the whale was mating, the testosterone levels went back up. So things like this were embedded within his earwax plug.
George Preddy is an organic chemist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Coming up on The Pulse, 3D printing organs seems to hold a lot of promise and the field is picking up speed, but there are some basic practical matters to consider.
If you have a company that wants to manufacture these and sell them to hospitals, they have to be able to preserve them, to put them in a freezer somewhere so that they can make many at a time so it's cost effective.
Freezing tissues and bringing them back, coming up on The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. March 31st, that is a big date in health news right now. Does it mean anything to you?
I heard someone posted it on Facebook.
But I don't know what's it about.
Is that when they want 6 million enrolled on Obamacare?
You got it, Daniel Scaife, a tourist visiting Philly from England. The Pulse's Alana Gordon is here. Hi, Alana.
Hi, Micah.
And you've been following the rollout of Obamacare for some time. What is happening with the deadline?
Well, as you said, the deadline is March 31st for individuals who want to enroll in health coverage through the Affordable Care Act to sign up. Otherwise, you have to wait till November to sign up for next year. So government officials, insurers, supporters are whipping out all sorts of tricks from their bag in these final weeks to try to get the word out. So you have everything from the White House creating internet gifts like cat memes to appeal to, you know, younger people. President Obama was even on Zach Galifianakis's widely popular internet show.
Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh yeah, I heard about that. That's the thing that doesn't work. Why would you get the guy that created the Zune to make your website?
Healthcare.gov works great now. And millions of Americans have already gotten health insurance plans. And what we want is for people to know that you can get affordable health care. And most young Americans right now, they're not covered. And the truth is that they can get coverage all for what it costs you to pay your cell phone bill.
Is this what they mean by drones?
So that got millions of hits and sent a lot of traffic to healthcare.gov, which is the federal enrollment website.
What's happening in our region? Are people signing up?
Well, there's definitely a lot of amped up activity happening. I was surprised to meet up with Enroll America, and they're actually phone banking people. They're calling people. They've gotten information of folks who indicated that they're interested in learning more about health insurance, and they're not just following up one time, but they're actually continually following up several times, kind of like a marketing approach. So they've recruited volunteers to actually call people.
That sounds almost a bit intrusive or potentially annoying.
You would think, but they're not just cold calling people. They're calling people who've indicated some interest in health insurance. So on Tuesday evening, I stopped in at their office to see how this would go. There were six people sitting around tables with detailed call lists and cell phones.
Hi, my name is Debbie Evangelisti. I'm a volunteer with Get Covered America. We talked to you a while back about your new health insurance options under the Affordable Care Act. And I wanted to be sure that you have all the information you need because time is running out. March 31st is the enrollment deadline.
So, again, they're calling people that they've made contact with before. And if people are interested, then they're directing them to online resources or to in-person assistance. Now, that's not to be confused. There was an issue sent out earlier this week from Delaware to beware of scams, people calling your phone and asking for actual premium information, things like that. So beware of that. But on the other hand, I also met up with a group from Project Home. It's a local social service agency. They're actually going door to door to let people know about the enrollment deadline.
Do they have a target audience? Do they know which doors to knock on?
Well, so Project Home is located in North Central Philadelphia, so they're trying to reach the neighborhood around that because they can also connect people with services. But they actually go out with voter registration lists, so it looks very much like a campaign operation. So I met up with Loretta Dredden and Kenyetta Parham, two volunteers, and it was very easy to spot them because they're dressed in these bright neon crossing guard vests with the word outreach stamped on the back. And they were just pounding the pavement.
The deadline is March the 31st.
They need to get with it.
This is the first time I did something like this for my community, so I'm really excited to be helping. Oh, they're not home? Okay.
So when someone's not home, they leave door hangers that have information on it. Now, one guy actually does answer, but he's not on their list. So, again, here's Kenyetta Parham.
Is there some information where they could call and set up an appointment to find out if they're eligible and to enroll? Thank you.
Thank you.
I should have asked him, was he insured?
Well, he was in a role.
I know. He was in his pajamas, so I think you guys did the right thing. No, it's fine. You gave him the information. He can pass it on to somebody else.
So far, we've been canvassing for maybe 2 hours.
I feel a little cold, mostly my hands, and I have gloves on. The fingertips is freezing.
So a lot of activity trying to get people signed up, but again, are people responding?
Well, Janine Miller is a policy director at Project Home, and she's hearing some responses from those door hangers. People have actually called to schedule appointments to sign up for health insurance. On the other hand, like we heard at the top of this segment, some voices of people saying, I think I heard something about it, or I don't know what's going on. There's a lot of national surveys, like the Kaiser Family Foundation, that point to a lot of people were not aware of this. We won't really know till the final numbers are in how this is all working, but we have seen upticks in enrollment. We also have about 160,000 people in Pennsylvania that have enrolled. Now that's out of more than 300,000 people who may be eligible. But it really varies it's between states. So on the one hand, you've got Vermont that has more than half of people who are eligible have enrolled. And then on the other end of it, you've got Iowa, South Dakota, where it's hovering somewhere around 6% of eligible people have enrolled.
So what are the next steps? Do you think there will be an even madder dash for the finish line before that deadline runs out?
Well, there have been reports that there's more traffic coming to the websites. I just talked with somebody from the NAACP here in Pennsylvania that had an outreach event earlier this week, and they had 100 people sign up for health coverage in one evening. You know, there are reports of an uptick. Like any deadline, often people will wait till the last minute. But I think after this, moving forward, one of the things that I'll be curious about and keeping my eye on is how this insurance works once people start using it. from the doctor's perspective, from the person who has it, how it works out for them. So lots of questions now that we're seeing lots of people sign up for this coverage. So we'll be keeping a lookout on that moving forward.
Alana Gordon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Time now for a science news update. Joining us is our regular Pulse contributor, Carrie Grant. She's an associate editor at The Scientist, and in that role, she reviews a lot of studies every week, and she keeps us posted on the latest. This week, Big Bang, ancient moss, and heart tissue. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Maiken.
Let's start with the Big Bang, I guess. What's happening there?
Well, this was big news in the Big Bang field this week. Scientists reported evidence that helps to describe what happened immediately after the Big Bang. So we're talking a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a second after the initial explosion that went on to create our universe. So, you know, everything explodes and starts spreading outward. And there's this theory called inflation in which the expansion of the universe speeds up for a very brief period and then it slows down. It keeps expanding, but the rate of the expansion slows down. If inflation happened, it would have created ripples in space-time, kind of like ripples in water that then grow and spread out throughout the universe. And scientists have been looking for these. These ripples are gravitational waves, and they finally detected them using a telescope at the South Pole. So the results help us understand what happened right after the Big Bang. Not everybody has agreed with this idea of inflation, and the results still need to be verified. Some are not entirely convinced just yet, but a lot of cosmologists are extremely excited about these results.
And why did it take so long to detect those ripples?
I guess it's really, really difficult to find them. They had expected that the signal would actually be extremely, extremely small, but what they were able to detect was a bit larger. So that's why people are excited by these results, because I guess the signal is a bit more convincing than they had even anticipated.
And what does this ripple, how does it manifest itself? What are you measuring?
In this case, they're looking at the cosmic microwave background. This is leftover heat from billions of years ago. And what they were looking at was the orientation of the microwaves, the polarization of them. And what they saw was a slight, they called it a curl, in the orientation of the microwaves. And that is indicative of the gravitational waves kind of passing through the cosmic microwave background.
And what is this setting the stage for? What's next in Big Bang research?
I think it will be to verify these findings. In science, you always want to have confirmation from other groups, other telescopes. You want to have independent scientists look at your data. So I think that's the next step.
Let's move on to ancient moss that was brought back to life.
That's right. Scientists have revived moss that was frozen in ice for 1,500 years. They pulled ice out of an island near the Antarctic and brought it into the laboratory, warmed it up, gave it some light, and much to their surprise, this moss came back to life. This really shatters records for how long a complex organism has remained dormant in ice. So recently, people have revived a 30,000-year-old virus from Siberia and other microbes people have brought back to life after a very, very long period. But for more complex life, plants and animals, I think the previous record had only been a few decades. So this was really exciting.
So what are they going to do with this moss now? Grow it? Grow it in their yards?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure what they're going to actually do with the moss. I think it helps researchers understand how organisms are able to survive through ice ages. So instead of having to rely upon getting off to a warmer region, perhaps they can stay frozen in ice and sort of hunker down until the ice melts back.
And finally, your last pick for this week is making heart tissue that actually beats.
Yes, there's been quite a few advances this year in making artificial heart tissue. In this latest case this week, scientists have engineered heart tissue that can beat, and then they generated it in the laboratory and then were able to implant it into a mouse. This is an advance on the road to regenerative medicine. So if you have had a heart attack and you have damage in your heart, for example, you'd want to repair that. And this is an advance in that field. It's not the first time that beating heart cells have been created in the lab. As I said earlier this year, a group in San Francisco took skin cells. They altered which genes were active in the cells and then turned them into beating heart cells. But what I found interesting about this latest advance was the scaffold that they grew these heart cells on, called a hydrogel, and it's supposed to be very elastic and durable so that it could perhaps be implanted and act as like a tissue patch. And they used a 3D printer to etch little grooves into the hydrogel, then seed that with the cells so that they grow into the proper architecture.
So are we getting closer to perhaps even making a whole heart that way or other organs?
That's the goal. And certainly these advances are getting us closer to that point. I will point out, though, this was all done in mice. And so we're not at the stage where we can start experimenting with implanting these things into humans. There has to be a lot more research done before that.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you, Mikan.
Carrie Grenz is an associate editor with The Scientist and a regular contributor to The Pulse. So if scientists are able to produce organs someday, maybe that day is not that far away, then that raises another issue.
If you have a company that wants to manufacture these and sell them to hospitals, they have to be able to preserve them, to put them in a freezer somewhere so that they can make many at a time so it's cost effective.
That's Jens Carlsen. He is an associate professor of mechanical engineering at Villanova University. His specialty is cryogenics. That's the freezing of tissues and cells. And he says there's quite a bit of work ahead.
The problem is that with current technology, when you freeze something living, like a living cell or living tissue, it's not as effective as it could be. So if you have something critical, like a liver transplant, when you thaw it out of the freezer, you want it to be 100% functional. If you're just freezing some cells that you want to use in your research lab, if you take them out of the freezer and 50% of them are dead, well, after a few days in an incubator, they will grow back. But you don't have that luxury when you're doing tissue engineering.
Carlsen is trying to improve the process of freezing tissues, and I asked him what the biggest problems are.
Well, so it's kind of paradoxical in that, you know, when you bring tissue down to very cold temperatures, minus 196 Celsius is liquid nitrogen temperature, they're very stable at that temperature. But it's in bringing it down to that temperature and also in actually transition it back up to room temperature and body temperature, that's when the damage can happen. And so, you know, people will be familiar with frostbite. So freezing tissues, you know, and a lot of times is associated with killing the tissue and killing the cells. And of course, we don't want that when we're trying to preserve an organ.
And what kills the tissue? What happens that is detrimental?
Well, there are many ways that things can go wrong. One of the really important mechanisms that cause damage in cells is when the water inside the cell crystallizes. So the cells contain maybe 70 to 80% water, and when the temperature is cold enough, of course, that water will turn to ice. And so it turns out that a lot of cells can withstand ice if it's outside a cell, but if the water inside a cell freezes, there's just so much molecular machinery inside the cell that it ends up destroying the cells.
Does it expand and burst things? I mean, that's just my very elemental understanding of what might happen there.
Well, that's probably as far as we understand it also with regards to exactly how the ice causes the damage. And of course, ice does expand, and it's not implausible to think that that plays part of a role. But also, you can imagine it would really crowd all the things that are in the cell, and it might just push things too close to each other so that they get kind of smushed in between these ice crystals. So we don't know exactly how the ice causes damage, but we know there's almost a one-to-one correlation between when we see ice form inside a cell and that cell then dying.
Can that be prevented, though? I mean, it seems like when you freeze it, then the water inside the cell is going to freeze too.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So it's not inevitable. We can prevent it. The way we prevent it is by taking some of the water out of the cell. So this can be done in two ways. Either you can add certain chemicals at the beginning of the process. So these are called cryoprotectants, but, you know, in kind of layman's term, you can think of them as an antifreeze type chemical. And they enter inside the cell, and in so doing, they replace some of the water. So you replace some of the water by this antifreeze chemical, and then you have less water, and also you've added this chemical that actually depresses the freezing point. And the other way you can remove water is actually, depending on how you freeze the cell, some of the water will actually naturally leave the cell. The faster you freeze the cell, the less time there is for water to leave. And so by manipulating the temperature history, or we call it temperature profile, so how the temperature changes with time, does it go fast or slow? We can go fast, maybe go slow initially, then stop for a while, then go fast for a bit. So there's many ways we can vary this temperature profile, and each choice we make has a different outcome.
And what do you do now with this information? What can that lead to?
Well, our goal is to understand these processes well enough that we can actually develop computer simulations that will predict whether a certain tissue or organ or cell will be damaged for a given freezing process. And by running that kind of simulation, you know, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, you could find the absolute best method for preserving that tissue. The advantage of our approach is that once we figure out what's going on, and once we've developed these computer simulations, we can use them and reuse them for every possible organ or tissue. The other benefit of doing the cryopreservation research now is that with tissue-engineered bioartificial organs, we actually have an opportunity to design the organ so that it makes it easier to freeze it. So we could, you know, put in different cell-cell connection proteins that behave in a better way already when we build the organ. So by developing that knowledge now, we can actually benefit the tissue engineering technology.
Jens Carlsen is an associate professor of mechanical engineering at Villanova University. Listening to scientists talk about their work is always fascinating, but there are plenty of opportunities for you to be part of science yourself. Our partner, SciStarter, is an organization that connects citizens to science projects. And we asked SciStarter founder Darlene Cavalier to give us a preview of some of the projects happening this spring. For example, you can measure rainfall, you can track cherry blossoms, or for the more ambitious among us, you could set up birdhouses in your backyard.
So this project has a couple of components to it. One is building the nest box and putting that on your property and keeping a careful watch for the development and the maturation of birds. This helps researchers at Cornell learn more about the biology of the birds and also migration patterns.
You could also help researchers at Drexel University chase down bugs.
Specifically looking for the elderberry longhorn beetle. You can check SciStarter and look for a picture of this beautiful beetle that coincidentally is carrying Drexel's school colors. It's blue and gold. But this researcher is really curious. Does this beetle reside in Philadelphia? It's truly a question he does not know the answer to and needs our help.
And here's the researcher in charge of that project, Drexel University's Dan Duran.
It's probably throughout this area, but we really don't know because it's one of those animals that you really have to go out looking for. And they hide in often marshy areas. If we find them, we probably have a good idea that an area is healthy. It's a healthy ecosystem because this is one of the species that should be there if you have a large, functioning wetland.
So bugs, beetles, birds, blossoms, lots to pick from. For more information, go to SciStarter.com. Coming up on The Pulse?
I measure things, I model things, and it gets summarized in figures and tables.
Science can be complicated, tough to relate to. An artist helps scientists make their point.
She does it by making paintings or photography. For most people, that is more accessible.
That's next on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Climate change seems to elicit a collective yawn from Americans. Surveys find it's not a priority at all. Here's Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll.
It's near the bottom of the list on every list of priorities that we come up with. We just don't find that the American public at this point are very concerned about climate change and global warming.
When scientists explain some of the intricacies of climate change, it can seem complicated and hard to relate to. Artist Diane Berko's paintings tell the story more directly and kindle a desire to find out more. Berko works hand in hand with scientists to explore, document, and interpret changes in nature, and scientists are using her work to explain theirs. Elizabeth Perez Luna visited Berko at her studio in Philadelphia's Center City.
Diane Berko is in essence a landscape artist. But if that term brings to mind quiet portraits of rivers and meadows, think again. Berko is interested in making vivid the forces that are shaping huge changes in nature.
Welcome to my studio.
Berko's canvases and photos depict melting glaciers and erupting volcanoes, jagged coastlines, and islands of ice upon chaotic waters. In her ample Center City studio, her work table has a rich palette of white, green, and blue paints. Every flat surface is covered with topographic charts, aerial photos, fat volumes from NASA and the U.S. Geological Survey. And maps,
what you see, it's
many
a
maps.
And you have this map of Antarctica. You know, the difference, people say, what's the difference between the North and the South? And clearly, the North is water surrounded by continents, and the South is a continent surrounded by water. But there are many other differences.
In this place where art and science live together and inform each other, Berko describes a work in progress, a diptych based on photos she took on a recent trip to Antarctica.
So in this painting, I'm making on the left sort of a landscape that I saw from a photograph that I took in Antarctica. But then on the right, you have this graph. And the graph came from something I read, which is about how ice is melting in different parts of the world. So there are no dates. There's no numbers. It's just an implication. It's just a graphic thing. And it's also color.
Rutgers University geography professor Osa Rennerman invited Berko to show her work and to lecture about her experiences at the Zimmerli Museum on campus.
She has another way of communicating environmental change than I do. I measure things, I model things, and it gets summarized in figures and tables and scientific papers and conference presentations. And Diane, she does it by making paintings or photography. For most people, that is more accessible, and I think it's something that can create an interest and curiosity among people to learn more.
Rennelman, who specializes in climate change, sees Berko as a scribe crafting an archive of things on the way to being lost.
You know, it's in a way a bit sad to see that some landscapes are gone for the rest of my life. And still, it's beautiful to see that it's captured by her art. It provides a record of something that was here, and now it's gone.
Photographs provide a basis for Berko's before and after imagery. But to feed her artistry, Berko frequently goes on location, to Alaska to look at shifting glaciers, to Scandinavia to look at receding fjords. In 2013, Berko spent her time commuting, so to speak, between the two poles. And as she has done for decades, she teams up with groups of scientists who are deeply immersed in measuring climate change.
If you know anything about geology, you know that it takes millions of years for glaciers to form. But these glaciers just keep receding. There's nothing left. Out of the 150 glaciers that used to be in Glacier National Park, I think there are 35. The rest are glacial lakes. That's pretty, you know, astounding. So with all that new information, in fact, I just got charged with this issue, and I guess I felt there was no going back. There was no way I could make a beautiful painting that didn't have another purpose. And exchanging ideas with and collaborating with glacial geologists throughout the world, it's a much richer life that I have, and I feel that I'm making a difference. I mean, people tell me I'm making a difference, so...
So much so that Burko is now an invited member of the University of Colorado's Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research.
Gracie and James had a hard life in Trenton. Gracie worked at
the exhibition, Sensing Change, at the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Philadelphia, presents images of ecological transformations. Burko is one of the artists whose work is in the show. Curator Christy Schneider says Burko uses scientific data as a point of departure, but her art transforms them into a gateway to scientific insight.
I'm thinking of a painting that she has in which she has the lines of a glacier receding, and she uses like red and a purple and maybe a pinkish color and a yellow. And so as you see her color choice, it tells you increasing danger, like going from a yellow light to a red light. And that's knowledge she brings as an artist, is color and what it means.
Diane Burko says she's just drawn to monumental landscapes.
I'm a girl from Brooklyn, so I don't want to paint asphalt. I want to look at these incredible, awe-inspiring spaces. And I sort of came to the landscape with that, but I wanted to be taken by surprise with it. I was sort of like a discoverer, you know.
For The Pulse, I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
Could robots help people heal and recover? That's the question at the heart of this week's edition of So What Do You Do? For this segment, we pair up a layperson with a researcher for down-to-earth conversations about science. Opera singer Valerie Gay sat down with Michelle Johnson, director of UPenn's Rehabilitation Robotics Lab, to ask...
So tell me, what do you do?
So I am director of the Rehabilitation Robotics Lab. It's a new lab that started at Penn. The focus of the Rehabilitation Robotics Lab is to put the two words together, thinking about stroke rehabilitation, thinking about people that have had a stroke, and thinking about robots and how you can design and build them to help these people recover function. I focus on the upper extremity and thinking about the arms and the hands and how people do activities of daily living, how they eat, how they drink, how they do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And the idea then is to figure out how robots could come alongside therapists and help in the rehabilitation process, help in the recovery of function in the upper extremity.
What drew you to this field?
In my master's program, it's a master's program in robotics. Kind of, I was attracted to that area, started to explore, you know, robotics and what does this mean? Intelligent machine sounds like really exciting future and very challenging. So my faculty advisor at the time had other students working with him. And he had a graduate student who told me one day, hey, I'm building a robot for a wheelchair. And all of a sudden for me, it clicked. It's the sense that, oh, wow, what I could do could apply to people specifically and people with disability. And simultaneous to that, my grandmother just had a stroke. And my grandmother had been a vibrant woman. A series of strokes had felled her and caused her to have significant disability. And it was almost simultaneously to discovering that what I was doing or what I was attempting to learn how to do could be applied to people with disability.
So as you were talking, I was thinking about, I'm very visual.
Yeah.
So what does it look like? How do they assist? Do you put them on? Do they walk next to you? Do they move your limbs? How does it work?
Great question. So robots look different depending on what you're doing.
Got it.
And there's, in fact, a robot that I just purchased for my lab. It's called the Baxter robot. It was original design for manufacturing. It's more like a humanoid type robot. Mm-hmm. It's pretty tall. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to kind of think about and study the process of getting robots to interact with other people. I'm talking specifically clinicians and therapists working with patients.
Got
and I'm thinking
it.
Of stroke patients. How do you help someone move? And how do you go through that process and trying to understand that process in determining, can this robot help in an intelligent way?
That type of robot, I would imagine the application for it would be that you could help more people if you could create more of these robots mm-hmm. that simulate the work of what these clinicians do.
My goal is not to replace a therapist or a clinician. You can never really do that. And there's something salient about that human-human contact. The goal is to develop systems and machines that can be intelligent assistants.
Understood.
And in the world where people are growing older mm-hmm. and the rate of people aging, mm-hmm. living with disability is beginning to outpace the mm-hmm. people that are healthy. Mm-hmm. So a therapist or a clinician, their effectiveness may be maximized in the future if they had intelligent helpers that could be taught to provide the repetitive help, the demanding, fatiguing help. I can now serve six people, right? And be now this clinician who can provide for six stroke survivors versus just one.
Got it. Thank you so much for talking with me and us about this. This is really, really exciting. And congratulations on all your work. And thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
Valerie Gay is the director of Art Sanctuary in Philadelphia and an opera singer, and she was speaking with Michelle Johnson, director of the Rehabilitation Robotics Lab at the University of Pennsylvania. Jeanette Woods produced this segment. To see photos of the robots, check out our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And if you want to be part of one of these conversations, email us at thepulse@whyy.org. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya Engler, Zach Zord, and Alana Gordon. Kimberly Haas produced segments for today's show. Laura Benchoff is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our assistant producer. Meg Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.